Hi, welcome. This is Gary Rogowski. Welcome to Splinters. I'm joined today by Ashley of Shallow Creek Woodcraft. Hi, Ash.
Hey Gary, how's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. Sun's shining. So this is one of our Q&A sessions where people have written in and asked questions, and or have, sometimes in class someone has a question and I say, "Hey, can I talk about this on the podcast?" So we've got a list of questions that folks are interested in getting some answers on. So Ash, you want to?
Okay, first question is Franklin, Chicago, Illinois. I'm a new woodworker. What kind of hand tools should I buy first?
All of them. That's an impossible question, Franklin, but boy, it depends a little bit on what you want to do, I think. But basically, well, I don't know. Ash, what do you think?
I guess chisels is the simple answer because
Yeah.
you're always going to use chisels no matter what kind of work you do.
But you
But
need measuring and marking tools.
yeah, I guess it falls into what do you consider being a hand tool? Yeah, you definitely need a combination square and a marking knife, chisels,
Yeah. Marking gauge,
marking
chisels.
gauge. Yeah, that's.
Nice to have a saw that you can cut wood with. I think you need hand planes. I absolutely believe in hand planes.
I
But
feel
you have
like
to know how to
everybody's.
sharpen them.
Yes.
If you can't sharpen them, they're just a source of frustration. So, yeah, it's tough when you first get started, what to buy and where to put your resources. So, in my setting up shop class, I'm going to have another version this fall, starting in September. I have people try and build a simple birdhouse and see how it goes. Just cut the pieces. Well, how do you cut the pieces? That's the first issue. How do you measure the pieces? How do you cut them? Do you have a bench? Do you have a vise? And so doing a very simple project starts to show you, oh, I need this in order to do this, and then I need this. And what do I need here in order to do that? So, really simple projects like a birdhouse, which are fun. I like doing them. Can help school you a little bit about the things you might need. But there are four basic categories: measuring and marking tools, cutting tools, abrading tools, which are different than cutting tools. So, the difference between a saw and a rasp is that difference. And then bench tools. So measuring tools, we've mentioned squares. I love my 6-inch rule. I think that's really important. Sterrett 604RE. It's very important to get the RE. I think that means reed end, but they have a side scale. But it's a thick 6-inch, so it's you can't sit on it and not
And bend
notice.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, and bend it. Because then you can only do curved work, and that's no
Yeah.
fun. But yeah, that's really important. Good pencils are really important. Cutting tools can be everything from chisels, saws, hand planes, drill bits. I mean, they're all cutting tools. But sandpaper really falls into the abrading category, like rasps and files, floats, those kinds of tools that work great but leave a very coarse finish compared to a hand plane. And then the last category is bench tools like a vise, clamps. I guess you put hammers in there, but vises and clamps and how you hold work is hugely important. And so, well, I have to build a bench first in order to do woodworking, which is hard to do because you don't know how to do woodworking yet. So, I think someone in class, in the mastery class, just had a, oh yeah, I'm thinking of him right now. Just had a metal vise for the first year. Got him by. You can pick three, Ash, out of each category. Three.
Okay. Oh, out of each category, not three total. Okay.
Not three total. So measuring and marking, what do you absolutely need?
That 6-inch rule is a staple. I have that with me all the time. I find them useful for joinery, layout, setup, everything. Honestly, I use that probably more than any other little tool in my shop. So that 6-inch rule for sure. A good marking knife, one where the blade is reliable and it's not wiggly. That's good for anything that you do with marking hinges, joinery, same thing. And then a 6-inch combo square. I would say that's the most flexible, although I do use a 4 a lot, but it just depends on the scale of what you're making.
You stole all mine, so I'll add three more. A marking gauge and sliding bevel, so an adjustable bevel, sometimes called a T bevel, so you can set angles. I think that's really handy. And a straight edge. Having a reliable straight edge really helps you in a lot of situations. And if you invest in it in a good one. And years ago, I had a student in class who was a machinist, and he said, "Hey, I'm putting in an order. You want anything?" And I said, "Well, I'd really like a 3 foot long straight edge." And he said, "I'm buying tool steel." So he bought, I think it's 3/16 thick, it's 2 inches wide, and it's 3 feet long. And at the time, it was under $100. It was probably closer to $50. And it's guaranteed to be within 2/1000ths of flat and 2/1000ths of straight. That's good enough for me.
Yeah, can't beat that.
And because when you buy straight edges from manufacturers, they put their name on it. That costs you money. As soon as, Veritas or Bridge City, or those are the other two I have had in the shop. Anyone else puts their name on it, then they're charging you extra. But it's just steel. That's it. It's just a flat piece of steel and really important. Okay, cutting tools. Three. One, two, three. What? You got three.
Definitely dovetail saw.
Which is a rip saw.
Yeah, rip. That's what I was gonna say. So cross cut too. So cross cut saw too is pretty handy. Okay, what else falls into the cutting tools category? My brain is stuck on saws. I'm like, oh, they cut it
Chisels.
all. Ooh, prop I probably use
Which one do you use the most?
that's what I'm thinking. 5/8, 3/8. I use the smaller ones a lot. I love that 1/8 size chisel is like a little secret weapon. That thing is that thing is the best.
You only get one.
I know.
It's a life raft. We can't carry all the
This
chisel.
is how this snowballs.
I know. I know.
Little
So
window
last
into the soul of a career woodworker.
and last year when the fires hit us up here and I had to bug out, I was like, okay, so what do I take? I should have had my list, right? And I said,
Oh,
well, screw
wow.
that. I'm going into the shop and I grabbed as many chisels as I could, as many hand planes as I could, as many of my hand tools as I possibly could. So I'd say a half inch chisel, a Japanese Dazuki saw for cutting joints, and a low angle block blade.
Oh, okay.
That those three tools would get me through a lot. Abrading tools, what are your favorite abrading tools?
The cabinet makers, I think it's like a 9-inch and it has a half round on the front profile because there's a flat on the back and then you have the half round on the front. And at the 9 inches, you have enough working space for bigger projects to smaller. I use them a lot with like the sculptural legs and things like that, but they're just great for into
What
corners.
else?
Well, I guess I would do a file. So after rasp, do file.
So I would have a mill file so I could sharpen my scraper. I have this little, it's probably 3/8 of an inch wide, model maker's rasp.
Ah,
And it's
nice.
about 8 inches long. I love that tool. I use it all the time. And I've got the cabinet maker's rasp you referred to, but I also like my dragon rasp.
Yeah,
That's
the model makers is a finer grain than the cabinet makers, right? It's just a smoother cut.
I mean, I can be aggressive with it, but I can also get into really tight spaces, and it's a nice detailing tool. I really like it. Okay, so what's the clamp you grab the most?
I use like a 6 and 8 inch clamp all the time on my bench.
But C clamp or F style
Just
or
little F clamps. Just F clamps when I move stuff around and clamp and move things. I feel like I reach for them the most just in
Uh-huh.
the regular workflow.
I've got a I grab for my pipe clamps. I use my pipe clamps for a lot of stuff. And then I grab those squeeze clamps, you know, that one-handed. I love those. I love those because you just need one hand and you can clamp something, holding it with the other hand. And so those are really handy. And then I have two sets of C clamps. Sadly, I lost a couple of them in the move, but I've got eight of a 6-inch C clamp and eight of a 4-inch C clamp. And
At least you lost them in an even number, it seems.
I did, but that's not a consolation, I can tell you. Well, I think we've given Franklin enough to chew on. Here's the thing about buying tools. You buy good tools, you only complain once, right? And when you buy good tools, they last forever. I mean, a saw might wear out, you know, you break a tooth off or bend it or something. Or chisels eventually do get shorter, but you know, most of this other stuff, it just keeps going. So there are no software updates. I like that. I like that a lot. I have a question for you, Ash. You've been woodworking now for how many years?
5, 6 actively, kind of in my own shop space, and then dabbling for probably a decade before that.
What was the hardest thing to learn?
The hardest thing to learn, I think. Joinery and wood movement rules in conjunction with each other. As I've designed more work that I want it to look a very specific way, is learning to respect the wood movement while also getting joinery that's structurally sound. So I would say those moments are probably the most challenging pause I've had as like a technical aspect. I think just like holding the chisel at the right angle from the very beginning when you're cutting different joinery, like learning to see what's 90 and relying on that, and then learning when it's a little off 90, where you can do that. I would say that at the very start, that was probably I needed to learn that and took more time with that.
That just takes time. I know when I started, I was okay. It's 3/16, but it's on the left side of the mark, so it's 3/16 minus, or it's 3/16 plus. I would go through all these goofy little machinations trying to be accurate, but without actually being accurate. You know, it depends a little bit on what kind of woodworking you do as to how accurate you have to be. If you're a winter chair maker, you have to be really accurate sometimes. And then other times, eh, paint it. Paint it. Don't worry about it. So it depends on the situation. But yeah, holding a chisel straight is a big deal. Patience. That's the big one. That's the hardest. That was the hardest thing for me to learn.
I concur. Yeah, fighting the being patient with perfectionism would probably be the emotional aspect for me, just realizing what your vision of things are and your abilities, and how those two things over time will kind of get closer to each other. But just that the notion of perfection is really not a reality that's rooted in this work, and it's a good self-discipline.
It's a tough one. But being patient with yourself and your expectations. And it's still a tough one. This morning I said, well, I'm gonna, you know, have to meet with Ash at 10, so I've got this hour and I'll do this, and that second hour I'll do that. Well, it didn't get done. It didn't happen. Because I said, well, I'll get all this done and then I'll go for my walk and I'll get all that done and then I'll go out and do some yard work. And it's like about half of what I dreamt of doing. I think it's easy to think I'm going to get a lot done and then fall short of that. So being aware, being patient with yourself and understanding what you can and can't do. You know, our eyes get real big sometimes. So it's good to let things come to you. Slow
Yeah,
down.
I call that the curse of the creative.
Interesting.
Just a creative brain. You're good at, making things that you want to do. You're good at making ideas for what you want to make. And they're always so big. And then, humanly trying to meet up to those things is
Right.
harder than, our brains are capable of creating. So,
It's very hard, and particularly when you're working on a piece and you've given a client a number. And that was always, I just found a, it was just a random piece of paper floating around the bench area, and I looked at it and there were hours, because I always kept track of my hours, and there are basically five categories. So millwork and joinery. And then I say SSA, shaping, sanding, and assembly, and finishing. So, and sometimes I would include design. The milling, the finishing, I those were pretty, I was pretty good with those. And over time, I got much better at estimating the joinery. The shaping, sanding, and assembly. Oh, there's no way I ever got that right. I never got it right because you're sitting there fussing.
Yeah.
That perfectionist in you is going, oh, it's not quite right. Now I gotta just give that, that does, that point doesn't fit right. I gotta fix it.
I
And that
resonate with
stuff,
that very much.
you, that just kills your time. And if you're in a production situation, you have to decide when to let go. And when I was doing a lot of commission work near the end of that time, it finally got to the point where I would just say to myself, okay, I hear you. You want me to hurry up? I'm not going to. I have to do this my way. So leave me alone. That led a little internal battle of the voices in your head. Hurry up, slow down, hurry up, slow down. Yeah, patience. It's a tough one. More questions?
Yes, sir. Okay, next question is from Maurice in Pocatello, Idaho. What's the best way to clean up glue in a box corner? Wash it, scrape, or cut it away?
Pressure washing, I think, works really well.
A good scrub.
If only it were that easy. Well, I cut it away. I wait 5 minutes and I cut it away. And if I'm in a situation where I can pre-finish the inside of the box and want to pre-finish the inside of the box, then it's even easier to let it dry and pop it off if I've got enough coats of shellac. So sometimes I was thinking about this, do a mitered box or a chest with a lid that you're going to cut off later on. So the lid is a part of the box of the chest. But it's easy to finish a piece that has miter cuts at the end, because you can come right up to the edge. You just don't be sloppy about, screwing up the joint. But it can be difficult with other kinds of joints, mortise and tenon joints and dovetails and stuff, to get that inside surface finished. Cutting away is my preferred method. How about you?
Yeah, I'll try to pre-finish when I can, especially if it's a box where the lid gets cut off. Sometimes I'll use a purple tape. It's good for marquetry work, and it's not as aggressive as blue tape. But you have to be careful that it is not compromising into the edges of your joint at all, because you don't want to
Right.
have your box glued up and then there's this like little shred of tape in the corner. Nothing will drive you
Exactly.
more crazy than that, and you would much rather be scraping glue out.
Yeah.
So
Oh.
it kind of depends on the box and like what I'm doing with it. I also have this neat little scraper that I think it's from Bench Crafted, and it's like this funny little, it's like a stick with a handle on it, and then the very edge of the stick has a scraper that's facing in reverse. So
Oh,
the
nice.
cutting edge of it is like facing towards you. And what's great about that is you can lean it into those edges, and it has little 90 degree corners on it, and you can drag it real slowly along that and scrape glue away if you happen to, not get it all cleaned up.
Interesting. Now I'll have to
Yeah,
check
kind of
that
a
out.
nifty little tool.
Another individual choice.
Try
Must
not
never
to have
thought
too
about
much glue.
it. Yeah, and that's part of it. So if I'm gluing up joints, I don't put glue on the close to the inside edge, particularly on end grain surfaces. On long grain surfaces, I do, and I expect a little bit of squeeze out. But I'll tell you, This was way, way back when I first started, and I was working in a co-op shop for a little bit. I was doing some stuff on my own, and then got hooked up with these guys, and there were about four or five people in the shop. And I was too self-conscious to watch them let me glue up my bookcase. So they all went to lunch. So I glued up by myself. I got glue everywhere. Glue, squeeze, I mean, dado joints, glue squeezing out. Oh, it was a nightmare because it all dried before I could get to it. It was just so silly. Yeah. You learn. You
Yeah,
learn. Yeah. Don't put so much.
a lot of learning along the way, figuring out what not to do again,
Yeah. Don't
after
put in
all
so much
this.
glue. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't worry about that. It's a crappy joint anyway, a dado joint. So what else?
Here's a
Yeah.
longer question. This one is from Zach Thompson in Grand Rapids, Michigan. This is about finish. Do you have a go-to finish or two or three you use on everything? Do you pick the finish for the project or do you let your finishing preferences dictate other elements of your design and projects? What criteria do you use to determine the right finish for a given project, or even to determine if you like or dislike a particular finish? Not looking for
Okay.
recommendations specifically, just picking the brains of other makers to better understand how folks think about these things.
All right, let's start at the beginning and see if we can knock these out.
Yep, so do you have a go-to finish?
You know that. What's the question? Shellac is the answer. Pretty much it. Once I learned how to mix my own, you can use it as a stain conditioner, so you can use it as a sealer coat. In fact, it's sold brand name of Seal Coat. You can use it as a top coat. Put down a coat of oil and then put your shellac over. Just so valuable and so easy to put down.
And then the next part of this was, do you pick the finish based on the project?
I don't. I'm not going to let the finish determine designing or building something. I choose my finishes from a particular perspective, and I always have. And one given, all my finishing situations are it's hand applied. I'm not spraying. And that's not true for many other people. They like to spray, but it requires different equipment. You think a spray booth, more fire equipment, space, a lot of that. So I'm working in a space where I can do my finishing, set it aside, and go back to work and make more dust and not have to worry about it. No, I don't let the finishes determine.
And then the last part of the question was, what criteria do you use to determine the right finish?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on its use, its purpose, how it's going to get abused. I think it's arguable. So I use shellac, I use linseed oil, and I use wax. Occasionally I use a wiping varnish, but I'll only use a wiping varnish when I have a situation like a dining tabletop or something.
That was my next
And
question, was what about a dining table? I always feel like that's the wild card for me because it takes so
yeah.
much use and food and water, it has all the elements right at it. So that's what always makes me take pause. Like what's the most durable that a client or a person building a table would be happiest with?
I know people like the, monocoats and the hard oil waxes or hard wax oils. There we go, hard wax oils. But I'm not a huge fan of them. I want more protection. So I'm a big fan of a product called Profin. Some people like Waterlox, but what I discovered is, so you put a coat on, you let it dry, you do both surfaces, you let it dry, you scuff it out between coats. The next day you put another coat on. I'd say a minimum 8 coats for a dining table. A lot
Okay.
of coats. Because I put four on this breakfast table that I made, and I thought, that'll be enough. It wasn't enough. And I used it. I was using it every day. It was a table I made for myself. And so it was getting spotted and stained, and I said, all right, if I want to eliminate that, I've got to put on more coats. So I scuffed the surface again and applied four more coats. And that's a wiping varnish. If you use an actual varnish, you probably could get by with brushing on three or four coats. But the rubbing out is much harder because the solids are much heavier. I mean, that's the thing about the hard wax oils. It's like, I don't want to learn about finishing. I'm just going to put one coat down here. And you run into situations where that's just not enough, or you want more sheen.
They're like all finishes. Everything sounds good marketing-wise. It's
Yeah.
sort of indescript, really, what's in the can versus the directions for it. But no, they take a number of coats as well. I do like one brand of a hard wax oil, and it's just a one-step mix. It's not like a two-part where you have to mix and do, and so it's more cost effective there. But I still do like three coats at least and see what the wood is doing from there. And from there it actually feels like, with as it settles, it feels protected. But anything less than that, one coat doesn't do it.
What's the one you like?
I like Osmo. I
Okay.
like the Osmo brand. It goes on nice and it cures well, but like I said, it's still three coats at least. I've had in the past where I did four. It depends on the wood, but like walnut, there's no way you could get away with one coat on that and it's gonna be fine. It'll look dry, like you didn't put finish on it hardly.
Right. I did a little research project on the hard wax oils. And from my perspective, I agree with you. The marketing just jacks that price up. I don't know that it's worth $70 a can or whatever some of these quarts go for. When you can buy polymerized tung oil, put a number of coats on, and then do a carnauba and beeswax blend, and there you
I think it's the
go.
whole idea of dry time that gets people, because everybody has this like production mindset of once I get the piece done, I have to get it out to the person. But all finishes need a cure time, so it doesn't matter if it's a hard wax oil or if it's a tung oil. It all has a cure time. So even though the Osmo feels more dry than a tung oil would, you still need 30 days before that's gonna, take abuse, like actual use. So at
Yeah.
least a couple weeks, 2 weeks to a month. I mean, I feel like most finishes need that. Short of shellac, really.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hard to know. What dry time is one thing, but there's dry time and then there's cure time. And I've never seen any literature that gives me enough real solid information on that. But this Profin product that I use, and let me just step back and say most finishing companies just lie to us. I mean, they just, or they don't tell us the truth. They say, it's this, but they don't say it's really this. Except Profin. Profin on its can says quick drying finish. And the first coat you put on and it soaks in and you go, well, this is easy. This is great. And then the second coat you put on and you're like, what's this? It's getting all tacky here. It's getting,
Oh,
and if you
wow.
don't wipe that off, now you got a mess. So you realize you got to wipe the excess off on the second coat fairly quickly. And the third coat, if you don't get on it, it's flashing off even faster. So the
Wow.
subsequent, it's very interesting. And so, I on bigger like dining tables sometimes, you put a coat on, and by the time you finish putting the final bit on, you got to get back to the front end and start wiping it off because otherwise it's hard to wipe. You can deal with it, you can put solvent on your rags and that sort of stuff, but I preferred to, I knew a guy who just would pour it on.
Wow.
He would just pour it
He's
on.
a
He didn't
gambling
want me
man.
finishing at all. He would just pour on a big coat and say, yep, that's good.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, that's nuts. Finishing, like anything else, requires patience. You want to do a good job, I think. And then how far do you want to take it? But that Profin dried really quickly, and then I would, I'd give it a week or so, a few days at the very least, to say that it cured so I could really rub it out. Because that's really your final step in all of this. And it depends on the piece. So back to this man's question. If it's a chair, I'm not gonna worry about that. I'm gonna put a, a few coats of oil on it and some wax, call it good. But a dining table is completely different. It does depend on the use. One of the things to remember about finishing is that the finish work isn't done until you let it cure and rub it out. Now, some finishes don't take much in the way of rubbing out. An oil finish doesn't take that much. And in the application of it, you can be buffing it. You can be applying it with your 600 grit sandpaper.
Yeah.
and leave an incredible finish. And so there's very little to do. There's not a lot of finish left on the surface, and other finishes require work to rub out and get them to look consistent and feel good. I think feeling good is probably as important as anything, and that's certainly the case with the wiping varnishes and varnishes that you can use. Is they won't feel good until you rub them out, but you've got to give it a little bit of time, and so that's an important part of it. So how much work do you want to do on your finish? Becomes a really important question. You can put a lot of time into it, but finishing is not like furniture making. Tell me a woodworker that you know of who's willing to strip their finish and start over when it doesn't come out right.
None
I don't know of
I could
anyone.
think of.
No one I can think of either. Because when you screw up the finish, you go, oh, I'll put something over the top of that, and that'll make it better. And it just makes it worse. But a finisher will go, oh, that's screwed up. All right, let's strip that off and start again. No, it's different. It's very, very different. Great. What's our next question?
Next question looks like a good one. This is from Gordy C. I don't know where he's from, but it's a sharpening stone flatness issue. Is it possible that my basic Norton flattening stone is not that flat? Overall, for sharpening, I use DMT Duo Sharp plates for general work, new blades or purchased used stuff, or reestablishing the primary bevel, and 4,000, 8,000, and 10,000 water stones for final honing and polishing. Off of my DMT plates, I have a nice even scratch pattern across the bevel. After I flatten the water stones and start polishing the bevel, the progress only shows in the middle of the bevel. If I go back to the 8,000 grit DiaSharp plate, it puts a nice even scratch back on the bevel. This continues. It's a pretty basic flattening plate. $40 is what I bought it for. Do I just need a better flattening plate for the water stones? I think the stones are decent. I purchased them from Lee Nielsen.
Well, I think the issue there is what's your standard? What's the reference? And a sharpening plate may not be flat. So you've got to check that. That's the first thing, is checking your scratch patterns. And one thing you can do when you're sharpening, even if you're using a honing guide, just do them in different at slightly different angles so that you can see if when you do the next grit, if it's consistent one to the next. But it sounded like that sharpening stone wasn't flat.
Yeah, it
So
being in the middle made me question whether he's freehand sharpening or he does have a honing guide. But either way, your hand pressure still makes a difference. So maybe the Japanese stones being softer than the plate that he's beginning with and way his hand pressure is, he's keeping finger dead in the middle, but it still seems like it would be on the outer edges of the chisel versus the center point.
I think in the note he sent me, that Norton stone is a water stone. It's not a diamond stone that he's
Oh,
using
okay.
as a flattening plate,
Oh, I
I
see.
believe. And
Okay.
so that makes the difference. I used to have a 220 grit stone that I would use, water stone, that I was use as my first, kind of shaping the edge of a tool. And you'd look at it cross-eyed and it'd dish out. It was so soft. It was terrible. And I just gave up on those. So for making sure that your sharpening stones are flat, I use a thick piece of glass. I have a half inch piece of glass, which, you bring a piece to your glass shop, you can walk away with a free piece of glass. I mean, that's the stuff they throw away. I remember going into a glass shop one time, got a half inch glass. And the guy's going through this giant pile of broken glass and air. So that stuff's readily available and it's flat. And then you use some silicon carbide sandpaper. I'd start at 600 grit and then work your way up. But make sure that everything is nice and flat, including your sharpening stone. So I think one of those Norton stones come with grooves in them for slurry and stuff.
Oh, okay. Now I know which ones they are. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but if they're not flat, you're going to have problems with everything else
That makes sense.
because it's wearing out in the middle, and so the edges are left high, and you sharpen your or flatten your stone on that, and your edges wear off, So your middle is left. So there's a hump in the middle, and that's where you're
Yeah.
hitting, and your edges aren't getting cut. So this was a student, a current student, and I wrote him back and said, try this. And he said, yep, it was the flattening plate not being flat.
It's
So
good to know though, because I think, like I said, that marketing of it's said to be flat, but not always true.
yeah, you have to be careful. And I have found that some manufacturers aren't even accurate with their numbering system, or it doesn't match other manufacturers' numbering systems. I tell you, the King brand of Waterstones was the best. I'm still using two of those stones. I've had them for decades, decades. But I start with a diamond stone, an extra coarse for shaping the edge, and then go to my 800 grit King stone, and then a two-sided stone, 4,000 and 8,000.
Yeah, that's what I have, the double-sided stones too. I think I have the same ones as your student. I think I could be butchering the name, or I don't remember it fully, but it's Ohishi or something like that. That's what they're two-sided. I like them, but there are definitely differences between the grits of which ones get, misshapen faster than others. I don't know if it really has anything to do with the composition of them or just happenstance, but yeah, I have a couple I
I
have to
think
be
it,
careful.
yeah, I think it has everything to do with the composition of them. The 8,000 grit stone that I use now is so soft. It's just in possibly soft. I mean, I put a little micro bevel on the edge of my chisels, and I'll lift it up, and I'll see a mark. I go, wait, I haven't started applying pressure yet, and it marks up really easy. So that stone is very soft, and
Stones like
I
that can
think.
go out of flat as you're sharpening them. So I guess it's good to be mindful of that too, like how long you've been working with that chisel or blade on that particular stone. It's possible that, it's out from where you started, but
Yeah, and you have to make sure that you're using the whole stone. You don't not just using the center because it's you feel confident and safe in there because you are dishing that out, and you have to make sure you use the whole surface. I don't flatten my stones very often. I don't like that. Usually, I can tell from the results whether I should move out to the end of the stone or something. A couple of years, whether I need it or not. Is that it? I think that's
Yeah,
it, huh?
that's all our questions.
Well, that was great. Thanks very much for playing along with me, Ash.
Yeah, it's always fun. Always fun to pick your brain a little bit and get to ask the questions,
More.
even though they're not mine.
Yeah, no, it's fun. So please send us more questions. Studio@northwestwoodworking.com is my email, or you can post something on the website there, northwestwoodworking.com. And yeah, please check out the classes. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you later.